Well, this morning we continue in our sermon series, Slings and Stones, Facing Our Giants. This is a deep dive series study into Israel's greatest underdog story, the story of David and Goliath. Today's topic, rejection must fall. Let us pray. O Lord, may the words of my mouth and the meditation of all of our hearts prove to be pleasing and acceptable in your sight. O Lord, our rock and redeemer. Amen. Well, I played football in high school. Actually played center. Now, for those of you who are not familiar with the X's and O's of football positions, what is a center? Well, a center is in the middle of the offensive line, and the center has really two major tasks. It's the center who takes the ball, snaps the ball from the field into the waiting hands of the quarterback, right underneath the center. And then simultaneously, as the center is snapping the ball, he is lunging forward to do battle with his greatest adversary, the nose guard or nose tackle, or if the nose tackle is shifted, perhaps a blitzing linebacker. Now, on the surface, it seems pretty simple. Snap the ball and block. Block a nose tackle who wants to eat your lunch. But like life itself, life, it seems at so many moments to be simple. We know that life is complex, and the role of the center is more complex. For example, the center is the captain of the offensive line. As he goes to place his hand on the ball, he is reading the defensive scheme in front of him, and he's commanding the guards and the tackles next to him. So on the surface, nothing's simple, really. There's some complexity. Now, I don't want to seem like a big braggart this morning, but I was a pretty good center. I was a pretty good football player. I did that job of snapping the ball, lunging and doing battle, oh, I love that, and barking orders at the other boys, that's right up my alley. So, my father worked at U.S. Steel in Lorraine, worked like his father before him in the bar mill. Being a blue-collar worker, and particularly during the economic boom of the late 1980s, my dad many days worked 7 days a week at the steel mill. And in 30-plus years of being a steel worker, there was never a moment, never a day, that my father would ever turn down the opportunity of overtime. So what that practically meant for me and my family was there were many games that my dad, he couldn't be there. He didn't have the luxury of a job, popping out of the office for a couple hours, making it up later like I have today. His was much more defined and demanding. Well, we were playing the Vermilion Sailors under Friday night's lights. We were leading in the middle of the third quarter by 10, but there was still a lot of time on the clock. And for a moment, as we were trotting on the field, I looked back at the stands, and I think I was looking, wondering if I could catch the eye of Carol Barson, that 10th grade beautiful girl, wondering if she was still here after halftime. I didn't catch Carol, but I did see something that left me breathless. Dad, standing next to the concession stand. And as we got into the huddle, my mind was just spinning. Did a machine break down? Did something happen? How did this happen? He was supposed to at least work to midnight tonight. Well, as I was thinking about that, I heard the snap or the clap, which means the huddle is broken, the play has been called, and now we are trotting. In about 12 seconds, first down and 10, the drive begins. And suddenly I realized I didn't hear the play. I turned back to Adam, the quarterback. I said, what's the play? I got it. And I got into my position, and suddenly it dawned upon me, I have the play, but I didn't hear the count. And the count's important. Are we going on one, hut one, or are we going on hut two? Down, hut one, hut two. The roulette wheel in my mind began to spin. Red, it's hut one. It's hut one. It has to be. Black, it's hut two. Down, set, it's two. It's two. Has to be two. Nope, it's one. Hut one, snap, and what I remember next. We're seeing lights and hearing the roar of whistles and seeing the descent of yellow flags. False start. Number 51, offense. 5-yard penalty, still first down. That next quarter and a half was the worst football I've ever played in my life. There was another penalty. There was a fumble on a snap. And that nose tackle suddenly was not only eating my lunch, but also eating dinner and breakfast as well. I'll never forget the walk from the showers, from the locker room, to the waiting maroon Dodge Ram of my father's. I will never forget the feeling of butterflies that I felt, so much more intense than the butterflies I felt for Carol Barson. At 17 years old, I was not yet emotionally equipped to understand that it is truly possible at once to hold a deep sense of foreboding, deep fear, and at the same time, a hopeful expectation. I wondered, after I threw my duffel bag into the back of the truck and stepped into the cab, I wondered what awaited me. Would Dad say anything? Would he say nothing? What would I say? Should I say nothing? I feared rejection, and I hungered for an acceptance that I always wanted. A deep sense of rejection, fear of rejection, and a yearning for acceptance. This is something all of us share in common. Well, if there's anyone who can teach us how you bring down the mighty giant of rejection that keeps us living diminished lives, it is David. Before David brought down a 9-foot Philistine by the name of Goliath, David brought down the much bigger giant of rejection. Rejection was actually part of David's formative years. Earlier in 1 Samuel, we learned that God had put an expiration date on the reign of Israel's first king, Saul. Saul was living on borrowed time as the ruler. Saul was incompetent, he was unfaithful, the list goes on. Nor were any of his sons going to succeed him as Israel's second king. God had another plan. So God sends the prophet Samuel to go and anoint, even while Saul is still king, his successor, Israel's second king. And God sends Samuel to one of the most unlikely places, last place in the world that you think you would find Israel's next king. He goes to Bethlehem. Bethlehem is not a hot spot of wealth, affluence, or power. You don't find the movers and shakers in Bethlehem. And I'm sure Samuel, though he never articulated it, as the Spirit led him to Bethlehem, as he passed the sign, "Welcome to Bethlehem," deep down he wondered as well, "God, how am I to find a king in a place like this?" Well, Samuel is directed to the home of Jesse. Samuel announces the reason for his visit. "I have been sent by the God of Israel to anoint one of your sons as Israel's next king." Look at Jesse's face. Look at his chest stick out. Like a good coach, he immediately gathers the starting lineup of his sons and he places them in order. Now, each of them will stand before Samuel. Samuel will discern, and the one who is to be king will be anointed with sacred oil. Now, both Jesse and the prophet Samuel, they expect that this is going to be a very short game, because this is the ancient Near East at the end of the Bronze Age. Both father and the faithful prophet expect that as soon as Samuel steps before the oldest son, the oil will spill. Firstborns, that's the stuff of kings. Well, the moment comes. Samuel steps before Jesse's first son. He closes his eyes. He lifts his vial. And then he opens his eyes. And you could hear a pin drop as he moved to the second son, closed his eyes, lifted the vial, and then down the line. Puzzled, Samuel turns back to Jesse and says, "Jesse, do you have any other sons?" Jesse closes his eyes now and looks down and says, "Yes, I've got one more. He's out tending sheep. He's my youngest son." They fetch David, and the shepherd boy enters the room, welcomed by the scowls of his resentful brothers. "This is not possible. This can't happen. Dad's son relegated to watch sheep, out of dad's presence for hours and days. The runt of the litter. Our odd son, that odd brother of ours who fiddles all day on the harp. There's no way David could be Israel's next king." Family rejection, as David was ushered in into that room, the family room, rejection was palatable. Samuel closes his eyes. He lifts his vial. And the oil is spilled. Divine oil soaks David's hair. It spills down his face and down his neck. A room a moment ago dank with rejection is filled now with a sweet aroma of acceptance. An acceptance for all of the family to take in. In our text today, no Israelite can muster the courage to go down into the valley to face Goliath. None of the soldiers could muster the courage. None of David's older brothers who are standing on the summit, they cannot muster the courage. And even Israel's king, the commander-in-chief Saul, cannot muster the courage to face the Philistine. The lack of courage on Israel's summit is palatable. It's David, the boy, who steps forward for this mission that can only be described as suicidal. He raises his hand and says, "I will bring down this giant. I will bring down this giant for the glory of God and for the tribe." Now, Jesse's rejection of his son by keeping him on the sidelines, keeping him out in the field with the sheep, you know, for Jesse, as a father, that may have been subconscious. But Saul's rejection of David in this moment is clear. Saul minces no words about it. There's no subtleties or complexity here. "You are not able to go against the Philistine to fight with him. You are just a boy, and he's been a warrior since his youth. David, you're not big enough. David, you're not strong enough. You don't have the experience. David, you are not enough." With that, a boy looks at the commander-in-chief and refuses to yield to the rejection of that man. No one, no matter their station or position or authority, is going to stop this boy from running to the stream to pick out his smooth stones. No human being, no force, no power is going to stop him from marching headlong with confidence into the valley to face Goliath. Such confidence. For David, what do you think is the source of this confidence? Sure, he has some resume of protecting sheep from wild animals. But don't you think deeper down, David could still feel the soaking of his hair? Do you think deeper down, he could feel the oil spill over his face and neck? Do you think deeper down that he still smelt that sweet aroma of the acceptance of the God of Israel? That oil was not enough. It was more than enough to not only fill his heart, but to fill his gut with courage. David's bravery sprung from simply his own accepting of God's acceptance of him. This was now his birthright. Because David trusted his divine acceptance, no giant was going to stand between him and the fulfilling of his destiny, God's design for his life. Seems to me that there are two types of people in the world. This may be too simplistic, but go with me here. There's one group of people who live their lives driven by so that. And there's another group, I would contend, much, much smaller, that their life is driven by the word because. So that or because is a choice. Really, none of us can escape. This is what the so that life looks like. I work out and eat right every day so that. I go to the best school that I can and make the best grades so that. I make money and gather symbols of success so that. I work all week to bring down corporate giants so that. I collect awards and promotions like some people collect coins, so that. I chair the PTA and I never miss a moment of volunteering in school, so that. I am driven what I do, so that I'll be loved. I do what I do so that I will finally experience the acceptance I've hungered my whole life for. Want evidence that many people are living driven by so that, the so that lifestyle? Consider your favorite social media platform. How many people every day take time to make a conscious decision to post what they post and then monitor it carefully for likes and comments? If you want to exhibit A, that so many folks are intent on presenting a life so that they may receive love and acceptance, I don't want to tell you to do it now, but go ahead and look at your smartphone after the sermon. The spiritual maladjustment of so that can also prove to be ruinous to the spiritual life. How many people here today and globally engage in practices of faith, whether it be praying or continuing to serve on the committee you hate serving on, or writing a check or showing up for worship, all springing from the insecurity called so that? I do these religious things, I do so that I'll be accepted in the faith community that I'm part of. And deeper, I do these things driven because of great insecurity so that I will somehow know someday that I'm accepted by God. The life motivated by so that is a life which springs from fear. The life that is driven by so that, instead of leading to your destiny, if you live this life, your destiny will always just be out of reach. David's bringing down the giant of rejection before he would bring down a Philistine giant named Goliath was not motivated by so that. David didn't raise his hand and volunteer to fight Goliath so that he could finally impress his father, Jesse, and receive his acceptance. Nope, that wasn't his motivation. He didn't step forward when no one else would step forward in order to approve so that he could receive the approval of his older brothers and be included in the cool kid club. Nope. He stepped forward not to impress Saul so that a medal of honor would be placed around his neck. That none of that was in David's mind and heart at that moment. David bravely stepped forward because he stepped forward because he still could feel the oil on his head, his neck, and his face. He stepped forward because he still smelt the sweetness of that oil, which marked that destiny-changing moment for him. David mustered the courage because he accepted his acceptance and trusting in that acceptance. He mustered all the courage he needed and more to bring down the giant of rejection. And you know what giant next. And nothing, because David was driven by because, come hell or high water, nothing was going to stand between him and his destiny, God's plan for his life. Now, David definitely had a defining moment when he knew that he was accepted by the God of Israel. And from there, he would go to live this bold life that we still celebrate thousands of years later. But what about us? What about you? Can you point to a definitive, dramatic moment which shows you and me clearly, no caveats, simple, clear, that yes, you are accepted. And if you accept that acceptance, because comes next. Is there a moment for you and me? The Apostle Paul, writing to the church in Rome, shared this. But God demonstrates his love for us in this. While we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. There was a moment. On a hill outside the city of Jerusalem near the garbage dump on a Friday afternoon 2,000 years ago, there was a king who wore a different type of crown. This king was the son of David and the son of God. And on that afternoon, he felt his hair soaked. And he felt tears and plasma running down his face. He was the grotesque symbol of all that is objectionable. At that moment, in an act of incomprehensible love, the Son of David, the Son of God, took upon himself all rejection. He placed upon himself what makes you feel objectionable. He placed upon himself as an act of love all the skeletons in your closet that you just hope will never see the light of day. It was placed upon him. He placed upon him all of your neuroses and mine. He placed upon himself on that afternoon in that moment of anointing our deeply held fears. He took all of our false starts, our unsportsmanlike conduct, our unnecessary roughness and personal foul penalties. All of it he took. All the rejection that we truly deserve, he placed upon himself. And as the anointed Son of David and Son of God closed his eyes, all of it lost its anxiety-producing power. And now our eyes have been opened because of this, to God's unconditional and eternal acceptance. right here, right now, a moment all of us share. Well, what's the response to such a gift? Unearned and undeserved. What's the response if you choose to accept your acceptance, accept what Christ has done for you? Well, you live a life motivated now because I'm eternally accepted, I can live at peace with myself and others, no matter what other people think. Because I'm accepted so lovingly, so unconditionally, I am no longer reduced to live this ordinary life, but now I'm free to take healthy risks. Because I have this acceptance as my birthright, because of what Christ did for me and that love poured out from that place, I now can engage in spiritual practices, not so that I may win that birthright, but I can deepen my gratitude as I continue to walk with this Christ. Because on resurrection morning, the Son of David brought down once and for all the great giant of rejection. It has no power over you and me anymore. I am now finally free to walk headlong into my destiny, God's design for my life, and your destiny, God's design for yours. When I finally took a seat next to my dad in the truck at 10:15 on that October Friday night, I could still see his face illuminated by dashboard light. What he shared with me is something reserved only for the two of us. But suffice to say, I never once again feared my father watching me play football. I still feared Carol Barson watching me play football, but not Dad. All fear was vanquished. Never had a night on the field like I did earlier that night. It's truly amazing when you simply accept your acceptance. It's truly amazing when you choose to believe that David's son truly took down forever and vanquished the giant of rejection. It's truly amazing when you begin driving your life with the word, because.